Chat with Traders is sponsored by Trade the Pool. Are concerns about limited buying power, insufficient capital, or fear of losing your own money preventing you from advancing your trading capabilities? Trade the Pool is an online stock trading prop firm that offers funding for stock traders. Demonstrate your skills, trade their capital, and keep your profits. You can engage in intraday trading and now swing trading on Trade the Pool with any U.S. stock or ETF. The procedure is straightforward. Pay an evaluation fee, successfully complete the evaluation, and get funded. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Markets, speculation, and risk. This is the Chat with Traders podcast, hosted by Aaron Fifield.
Hey, what's up everyone? Welcome to episode 167 of Chat with Traders podcast featuring Bobby Cho. So Bobby first appeared on the podcast in August last year. Some of you may recall that episode. He's the global head of trading at Cumberland, which is the crypto arm of Chicago trading firm DRW, and it's one of the largest liquidity providers in the crypto space. I thought it would be fitting to check in with Bobby again because of the events which have unfolded in cryptocurrency markets over the past 12 months. So our chat actually begins with some of the highlights from the recent Cumberland Summit, which was an industry event for insiders. Then we discuss Cumberland's international expansion, and from there we get into Bitcoin's sudden rise and decline from 20K, whether or not crypto markets have matured, decentralized exchanges, crypto's value and use cases, institutional involvement, and the bigger picture as we move forward. If I happen to miss any topics that some of you diehard crypto fanatics did want to hear about, sorry, please don't be too mad. I would suggest, though, going back to episode 139, our first podcast, because we spoke about other topics then. Anyway, without any further delay, let's get into it. Here is my second conversation with the man, Bobby Cho. I mean, we might as well just get started now, I guess. I mean, I was looking at when we actually did the interview last time, and it was August last year, I believe, is when we actually spoke and recorded it. I think it came out a little bit later, but I was looking back at the price of Bitcoin then. It was $4,000. So there's certainly been a lot happening since. So we've got a lot to get into. But before that, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the Cumberland Summit. I saw some photos that you were posting on Twitter. It looked like a bit of fun. How was that?
Yeah, it was great. So obviously we have a number of counterparties, you know, all over the globe. And along with counterparties, we have a number of service providers that we deal with, you know, exchanges and infrastructure players as well. And so we said, well, man, why don't we put on an event where our, you know, let's call it our network is able to network with one another, right? And really the genesis of it came about where we saw what some of the larger firms were doing with their, you know, either their customer base or their client base or counterparty base, such as like the, you know, the Salesforce Dream Summit or things like that. And so we just basically said, hey, let's open up kind of our network to themselves so that they can build synergies and really see that, you know, what we're trying to do here is trying to grow the industry. And it was not open to any media. I think people had, people really enjoyed kind of the conversations that happened there.
Yeah. And was that in Singapore or was that in China? Chicago?
No, that was Singapore. Yeah. So yeah, okay. I think part of it was, we tried to couple it in because it's not very easy to get to Singapore. Well, for you it is. For most people on this side, it's not that easy. And so we said, well, let's couple this with some of the conferences and events that were happening in Singapore. And so we were very surprised at the RSVP rate of people coming. We had thought, you know, hey, you know, it's a big ask, but I think when a few pieces came together, I think everybody felt like it'd be a worthwhile time.
Yeah, it certainly looked as though you had the kind of the who's who of the crypto world there. I noticed the Winklevoss twins, the Binance guy was there, and obviously many others. So yeah, no, that's very cool, man. What was the general sentiment like in the room, like general sentiment on the actual crypto space and where we're headed from here?
You know, since everybody's so tied into the crypto space there, you know, obviously people are very bullish on the outlook of the industry as a whole. We had people from both kind of the crypto asset side along with the blockchain technology side. And so it's good to kind of get both those feelings. And it seems like on the blockchain technology side that it seems like products are now being delivered and being tested against, which is nice. On the crypto side, you know, everybody acknowledges that we are in a different environment than we were in Q4, Q1 this year. But at the same time, I think, and I'll go into this kind of in my chat, is that it helped a lot of these companies build infrastructure around what they were doing. Because I think if the pace at which the industry was evolving or prices were the way they were in Q4, Q1, it would have been much, much harder for those companies to build kind of scalable solutions for the customers.
So when you're saying companies here, like what sort of companies are you referring to?
So the demographic of the people that were there were obviously, you named it right, exchange operators. You had funds, which, you know, are typical counterparties. You had different protocols, or I guess you can loosely call them, you know, crypto projects that we wanted to bring together with investors.
Okay. And as you had, you know, such a great group of people in that room all together, I mean, what were some of the highlights of that for you? Was there anything which was said which was kind of surprising for you or shocking in some ways? Like, was there any sort of notable topics that were discussed?
It was basically, we had created an agenda for people, but at the same time, you know, there wasn't anything, you know, let's say recorded or anything like that. But it was kind of everything that was going on in the industry at the time. You know, one of the things that we have mentioned was like, you know, some of the panels and topics were like mining versus staking and just kind of the relevant things that were happening in the industry. And also, you know, it was kind of like a fine balance of basically, hey, well, we want people to feel like they're in an open environment and that they can be transparent with this network. And we obviously wanted to respect that privacy aspect of it as well.
Okay. And maybe similar sort of question phrased a little differently. Was there anything which kind of got you excited? Was there any talk about upcoming developments in the space?
It wasn't discussed there, I'll say, but what we did see was you think that the crypto industry is, you know, fairly small and compared to other asset classes. And I'd agree with that. But it was really interesting to see the dialogues and the connections that were happening between different companies from Asia versus the US, gathering information, just how things are being done in different parts of the world. And I think getting that cohesion amongst the network was something that for me, that's probably the greatest output that we could have gotten from that event.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's cool, man. So are you guys doing this each year or what's the deal?
I think that's the idea, but we haven't put anything down on paper yet, but the hope is that we'll kind of see how the year develops and maybe that will become part of it.
Okay. So you said that was in Singapore. And I'm pretty sure you guys have opened an office in Singapore since we last spoke. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So I want to say it was right around October or November of last year that we had officially opened Cumberland in Singapore. And that was kind of a good natural step for us, mainly because DRW already had a presence there. And so infrastructure is already set up and things like that.
Okay. And do you have an office anywhere else besides Chicago and Singapore for Cumberland?
So, we do have different locations all around the globe, which kind of helps, one, do our business 24/7, which I'll go into in a little bit. But so we're headquartered here in Chicago. We have offices in London and Singapore. And about 3 months ago, we launched our Tokyo office. More recently, we launched Seoul, South Korea. Our Japan and Korea office are more of in a discovery mode, if anything, and just trying to figure out kind of the lay of the land, what's going on there, and how we could, build a business there.
So where are you spending most of your time now?
It is in Chicago. Everything that I do kind of internally, although I do manage the trading desk and kind of our operations folks and the broader business, my main focus is just making sure that the company as a whole is operating efficiently and to the caliber that we hold ourselves to.
Right. And what's the idea of having all these various offices in different locations around the globe?
Sure. That's a good question. So I'll just say that Singapore and London were kind of natural hubs of whether you want to call it financial activity or, you know, crypto asset activity. That was just natural to us. And that helps us provide markets to our counterparties on a 24/7 basis, right? Because, you know, when Chicago leaves for the day, Singapore gets into the office and, you know, London then gets in and then we pick up the book from London. The reason why Tokyo and Seoul we're looking into were mainly because of some of the specific jurisdictional, you know, regulatory environments that crypto lives in those regions. And so we realized very quickly that it was hard as, you know, a company that's not boots on the ground there to get involved and figure out what's going on.
Yeah. Okay. And so were you not always a 24/7 operation?
That's correct. So I think it was in Q1 of this year that we had launched 24/7 operations, and that means everything from providing markets, quoting, settlement, and everything kind of comes along with that. That's when we had built out that infrastructure in Q1. And a lot of the things that we do at Cumberland are driven by our counterparty feedback. What we had noticed was that people wanted to trade with us. Well, one, it was a symptom of the underlying market being, you know, 24/7, but we realized our counterparty base was also wanting to trade 24/7. So we said, how can we get this going in a manner that we felt comfortable with in terms of, you know, risk management and trading? And so, we got that up in Q1.
I guess I should probably, ask you just to, real quick, just to explain actually what Cumberland is, because I'm sure there's people who are going to be listening to this podcast who haven't heard our last conversation. And if they haven't, they should go back and listen to it. That was episode 139. But just so the rest of this, you know, our conversation here makes sense to everyone, can you just give us a real quick recap on Cumberland and what you actually do there?
Sure. So Cumberland is the crypto trading arm of DRW. DRW is about a 900-person principal trading firm across multiple asset classes. Cumberland's no different. We are one of the largest principal liquidity providers in the crypto space, where we make two-sided markets for different institutions, whether you're a fund or a different entity out there that's looking to get access or liquidity in the crypto asset space.
Okay, so like you just said there, your customer base is mainly institutions, and sorry, I forgot the other title you gave there, but
oh, I just said entities broadly, but so it's not our customer base per se. It's more we deal with counterparties,
right?
So DRW as a whole, we have no investors, no shareholders, no customers. Everything is on a principal basis.
Yeah, have you noticed that the sort of the people who are coming to you, who you're dealing with, are different? It's sort of changed over the past year or so?
I think so. I think what we saw, especially when we launched Asia, in terms of, well, the number of funds, crypto-specific funds, I think it's upwards of about 300 now. And that, you know, evolution really came about, you know, I want to say the last time that we had chatted last August. That's when, you know, I think there was a lot of interest pouring into the space. Obviously, as the price started to ramp up from, you know, the August pricing that you mentioned of 4,000, you know, hitting the peak kind of in December and January, people started to create their own funds and fundraise. And so funds are definitely a profile of counterparties that we make markets for on a daily basis. But aside from that, we'll, you know, we deal with a number of high net worth individuals or family offices, and a number of traditional funds that have kind of carved out things on the GP side of things to trade the asset class.
Can you just dumb this down a little bit further? So when you're talking about making markets for your counterparties, you're talking about making markets in like an OTC type of way?
That's correct. So traditionally, we had done transactions or quoting or making markets to our counterparties via voice or by chat. So that was typically done over some sort of communication portal, and that's how we did it. And as I mentioned before, in terms of we really value the feedback that our counterparties give us, because that that helps us get better. And so two of the developments that we really started to dig into this year was the idea of how people could interact with us in a non-voice, non-chat way. And so we looked at how other traditional markets were doing it or how they've evolved. And so we concluded on two things, two which you know, we're really excited about in terms of presenting them to our counterparties. But one, it's an API that people are going to be able to see our pricing, whether it's on a streaming basis or something like that. And the other thing is a platform base, or we call it a single DR platform, where people are now able to log in and view all of our markets in a more visual standpoint than the API would.
Okay, that's really interesting.
Yeah, you know, again, it's all driven by just what our counterparts are looking for, and we really take that to heart because, again, that helps us get better.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a much more efficient way to do it, I'd imagine.
It's kind of just like there's kind of a method for an array of different counterparties now, and I think it actually helps open up the way that people interact with us much more wider than before.
And why are these counterparties dealing with you specifically, or, you know, other desks who do things similar to what you do, instead of just interacting with the actual, you know, various exchanges?
Sure. So there's kind of like a there is a trust factor involved with that, and then there's also an efficiency standpoint with it. And I'll go into both. So on the trust side of things, obviously DRW has been around for greater than 25 years. So we leverage a lot of what DRW has done over the past few decades into what we do on a day in, day out basis. And so in terms of being able to manage risk, in terms of being able to provide the markets that we do and the spreads that we do, we wouldn't be able to do it without the infrastructure of the broader organization. And so I think people come to respect that and they like that feature. And obviously balance sheet plays a factor into it as well. And then the second part is, you know, in terms of exchanges, we work with a number of exchanges, but we are a risk-taking entity. And so what I mean by that is that we can provide, I think, a greater level of liquidity for certain coins that are out there than possibly other exchanges. One of the main features of efficiency that we like dealing with on the OTC side of things are institutions are very mindful of whether it's internal cost of capital or their return on their capital. And so when we trade, it's on a bilateral basis, and settlement happens after execution. So we don't hold anything in advance of any transaction, whereas an exchange, you need to hold the funds there for the time that comes that you actually want to do a transaction. Well, that tends to not be an efficient way to manage your capital. And so, you know, just the way that we trade and settle, it tends to be a little bit more efficient for certain funds out there because of whether it's size or just the capital efficiency.
And what markets are you dealing in now? What products? I know, obviously, Bitcoin, but
yeah.
I believe you've kind of expanded the products that you're dealing in as well, the different coins and that sort of thing since we last spoke as well.
Yeah, that's right. So we trade upwards of about 35 different cryptocurrencies. You know, most of the top, you know, coins by market cap, and, you know, other ERC-20 tokens as well. And then along with that, we also trade, you know, whether it's cash settled or physically settled futures as well. So it's not just the number of coins has expanded, but kind of also the product set at which crypto assets are traded in.
Yeah. How do you feel about the introduction of Bitcoin futures? Like, is that something which was welcomed by you guys?
I think so. We were there day one on the CME and the CBO launch. We've seen those markets continue to grow over time. I think you're seeing kind of more volume going into the CME market. I think mainly because of its access and reach to the broader kind of futures market. But I think it gave an opportunity for those that wanted to participate in the market, in terms of whether speculating on price or putting on a position, without actually having to hold the underlying or deal with kind of that side of the trade. And so I think it's all net positive. But at the same time, you know, I think you know, there are more and more infrastructure providers out there that are building products that that may be better in the future, but that's kind of where we are today.
I guess we should get into talking about the big run up towards the end of last year. Like I said earlier, Bitcoin was around about $4,000 when we last spoke, August 2017. How was the run up to 20,000? Like, what was that like for you to be trading and making markets during that time?
Along with working in an environment where kind of the land around you continues to shift, whether it's because of different movements that are happening on the regulation side of things or infrastructure side of things, you know, then you add on kind of the volatility of the market. And so I'll just say every day was an adventure for us. We got a lot smarter at what we're doing. It helped make us realize how we can scale better as a business. And also just how we can manage risk better as well. And so I think obviously those were very volatile, very adventurous times. And so I think we're in a much more sustainable kind of pattern in the industry right now.
As a market maker, that type of environment, is that a good thing for you, or is that put you to the test a little bit?
I definitely think it puts you to the test. I think it tests your ability to manage risk. It tests your ability to provide markets and be accurate on everything that you're doing. Prices were all over the place. It makes you become super efficient on how you're managing your coins and cash, making sure you're getting, you know, the return that you'd like on every single dollar that's on exchange or every single dollar that's out the door or every single coin that you're trading. It makes you be much more mindful about every part of your business because things are happening so quickly and you need to have a pulse on everything that's going on. It definitely stress tests things, your own operations internally.
Was there a point during all of this where it sort of clicked that this was all becoming very bubble-like?
I think very early on we said that the markets had bubble-like characteristics. I think the broader audience or the community recognized that this was not, the velocity with was not sustainable. And so really when you started to see prices kind of come off in, you know, in later Q1 and the subsequent months, you know, I think that actually gave the industry an opportunity to take everything that they had learned from the previous quarters, in terms of, you know, stress testing their operations, things like that, and we're no different, and gave them opportunity to actually build scalable solutions for the marketplace. And that's where you're seeing a number of different infrastructure providers come out, whether they're new entrants or older entrants, whether they're, you know, building out their current offerings or offering new things. So I think that really helped the industry figure out kind of where they were at and how things could end up going down the line.
And when you sort of sense that, you know, we were entering a bubble or this was becoming very bubble-like, was there anything which you had to do to kind of prepare for the backside of this move?
It's a good question. I would say that, you know, we try to approach every single opportunity by just looking at the broader picture, not just kind of living in the moment. And so you obviously have to, from a risk management standpoint, understand that things don't always go up and to the right forever. And so you have to understand that, well, you need to be mindful of all your open settlements. You need to be mindful of all the transactions that you're doing. And so so I'll just say that, you know, we kind of anticipated that, you know, pricing could correct. And I think any trader out there would have recognized that as well. It was just, you know, when was that going to happen? Was that going to happen at 20,000 or is that going to happen at 40,000?
Mm. And what about when it did, you know, turn around on the flip side? How was the decline for you? I mean, was that, I presume that was probably interesting times as well. Did that have any greater impact on your business as opposed to when it was ramping up?
No, I don't think so. I think if anything, you know, what we are in the market every single day providing two-sided quotes. So whether the market is going up or whether the market is going down, we are going to step in and provide you a quote or quotes. And so there, it was kind of no different. It was just the reverse, basically. And so even today, where you see kind of pricing trading in a fairly tight range over the last few months, we're still being very, very active and aggressive out there.
This whole thing where, you know, Bitcoin's gone from, well, depends how far back you want to go, but let's just talk about from, August last year, it was $4,000. Everyone thought it was really high then. I shouldn't say everyone. There were many people who were saying that. We saw it go all the way up to 20,000 and it's come back and it's sort of flown just above that $6,000 mark for a while now. For someone like yourself who's been active in the crypto market since, I think it was around about 2012, you might have been earlier that you...
Right around 13.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've been doing this for a while. Are there some things you've learned or some things which have been confirmed over and over for you about, you know, how markets work, how markets move, and how market participants think?
I would just say probably the biggest takeaway that I try to instill kind of everybody on the desk, everybody that works for Cumberland is in this market, especially because it's still growing and it's still very new and infrastructure is still being built out and still very early. Never assume anything. Always do the work. That comes down to, the addresses that you're sending coins to, in terms of double checking that. Just never assume anything in this market and make sure to validate kind of everything that you're doing over and over again. And I try to kind of beat that into the team every day just because things just change and you just have to adapt to what's happening around you.
Are you a developing or seasoned day trader who trades the U.S. markets? Is the only thing stopping you from getting to the next level is having enough capital to trade? Trade the Pool is a unique online stock trading prop firm that funds stock traders worldwide. Not having to risk your own capital can help you focus on other things like making better decisions on your trades. There's no PDT rules to worry about. You got more than 12,000 stocks and ETFs to trade, long or short, and professional tools at your side. How you get funded is you show them your skills through a straightforward evaluation process. Once you pass the evaluation, you get funded and trade with their pool of money and split the profits. Don't let the lack of buying power, capital, or fear of losing your own money prevent you from taking your trading to the next level. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
And what do you make of the fact that Bitcoin's kind of fluctuating around the $6,000 mark? Like, it seems to have almost found a little bit of support there. Is there anything which you read into from that?
Not too much. I look at kind of like the broader picture of what that provides to the marketplace. And I'll just go back to the fact that it allows people to kind of go back and focus on building scalable products and solutions for the marketplace. And granted, we are kind of in this low volume environment. That really provides an opportunity for companies to reassess what they're doing. And to some degree, there is a level of consolidation that's been happening in this environment and in this market. And so that makes business plans of a lot of these companies have to be much more bulletproof than they were, in the run up of Q4 last year. Right. I think even whether it's an ICO or a different protocol that's out there, I mean, people have gotten smarter over the past year. They know the right questions to ask. So you better believe that the economics behind your token offering, that the economics behind the token that you're launching needs to be much more soundproof, because people have seen the boom and kind of, if you want to call it the bust, of a lot of these projects.
Yeah. Would you say also how volatility is decreased over the last sort of little while, that it's possibly a sign that the market has matured a little bit as well?
Yes, I think that can be a safe assumption, along with the other products that have been launched out there in terms of futures and other products like that, allowing people to participate on both sides of their perspective.
Yeah, and what about the altcoin space? How has that been affected by all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're seeing it in the numbers. A few months ago, I kind of looked at one of the articles and said that 60% of all ICOs have gone away and they're not relevant anymore. And so, again, going back to the whole, you know, sound business models, they need to be tougher today than they were a year ago. You know, I think, you know, the altcoin market volumes have definitely dried up. Things have become very, very illiquid, even more illiquid than some of the other cryptos out there. And there's been sort of this, whether you want to call it like flight to quality or flight to safety, but it's kind of gone back to Bitcoin a little bit. The interesting dynamic kind of that we've seen out of Asia is that, you know, more than 10% of the transactions that we do during Asia hours are actually Ethereum based, more so than the US hours. And so that was an interesting dynamic for us, mainly because it gave us an idea of kind of what our Asian, the folks that are trading with us in Asia are doing and transacting in and excited about and involved with.
Now, I guess just taking a little step back, you know, that run up to 20,000, I don't know, maybe you can share your thoughts on this, but I think, you know, if we were just to make a general assumption, it was a lot of it was driven or fueled by people thinking that Bitcoin and some of the other coins could possibly become widely accepted as possibly a form of currency. You know, is it safe to say that the majority of people no longer believe that this is still the case?
I actually want to say that the run-up in Q4 and Q1, or kind of the broader tail end of last year, was driven mostly by retail. And I think most would agree with that. And I think you actually saw a number of places, you know, different jurisdictions, different regions, where being able to trade crypto became more accessible. And so that's why you had, you know, premiums on various different exchanges that were maybe servicing, you know, people in Japan or servicing people in Korea or in India or different places like that. So you basically had pockets of retail investors and traders that now were accessing a market that kind of, you know, they were able to kind of play off of the market side of things, but also there's this technology aspect to a lot of these coins that they can express their views on. And so I think that was kind of a big catalyst to the run-up. I still think the whole use case aspect of whether it's Bitcoin or other crypto technologies out there, it still lives today. It's still being built on and iterated on. But I think a lot of that was kind of trumped by just the price action that you saw day to day.
Yeah, but I mean, why was retail buying this up? I mean, what was their motivation for buying into this? Was it just to try and get rich, try and get a Lamborghini?
You know, I don't know the exact answer, but I can look back at history a little bit in terms of, you know, brief history. You know, the run up for Bitcoin going into, you know, let's call it $1,000 or $1,500 a few years back. I mean, a lot of that was driven by China. Well, why was that driven by China? Well, it's because it gave them an outlet to or an access for loosening capital controls. And so people realized that there was this vehicle or this asset that they can get into, and they can then go ahead and send funds all around the world however they like. And so I would actually look at the regions during the run-up of Q4 that they had very similar profiles of just capital controls in place. And how they were able to access those markets that they couldn't before.
Yeah, okay. So I guess, you know, if we go into this a little more, what I'm sort of trying to get at here is, where's the value in Bitcoin? Like, where do you see the value in it now? You know, I know a lot of people are asking this. I posted in the Chat with Traders Facebook group and mentioned that I was going to be having you back on, and this question sort of came up a few times. You know, what is the real purpose? There's a question that a lot of people are asking, like, what purpose does crypto serve beyond just speculation?
Sure. So I think the bottom line to level set everything is that it's still very early on. And so what you have are, you have a number of entrepreneurs, whether it's in Bitcoin or other crypto assets or even new tokens. Everybody in that space is still trying to figure out the killer app or the killer use case for cryptocurrencies. So that's where we're at today. But when I look at kind of whether it's like, you know, you want to put a valuation on Bitcoin or anything like that, you know, if you were really to take a poll and all around the world and say, well, what's Bitcoin good for? You are going to get an array of different answers out there, mainly because it's going to mean something different to different people. And what I mean by that is, just by our counterparty base in general, you know, people look at Bitcoin as almost a store of value, right? Especially with pricing being where it is, right? So gold 2.0, well, the critics of that use case said, well, Bitcoin's too volatile. It can't be a store of value. Well, now Bitcoin isn't as volatile. So maybe people are considering that it could be a store of value. That's one way people can look at it. Other people look at it as a way of payment. And we deal with corporates every single day that use Bitcoin for their service, where they get paid in Bitcoin because it's quicker, faster, easier than traditional channels. So that's another use case. And so people are interacting with, you know, I'll just say Bitcoin directly in different ways than the next person. And so I think that's where kind of the difference comes about in terms of how people are looking at the space, because they know the world that they grew up in and the rules and regulations that they live within, and that's how they're going to view Bitcoin versus somebody who may have grown up in a very capital controlled environment and where kind of governments can control a lot of the aspects of what they're doing, and they may look at Bitcoin very, very differently than the other person. So hopefully that helps kind of round out the view of why there are so many different views on the price of Bitcoin and what it's worth and what people are using it for. The bottom line is people are using it for a lot of different reasons. And so I think that's also one of the fascinating parts about it.
One of those reasons you sort of briefly touched on earlier was the technology aspect of it. Being as involved in the space as you are, have you seen any notable applications of blockchain being used in the real world?
I think people are still, there's this whole concept of like private blockchains versus public blockchains. But I think on like the private blockchain side, I mean, that's kind of going full steam ahead. There are a lot of enterprise companies out there that are building products for a number of institutions out there, whether it's on, you know, the financial services side or anything like that. And on the crypto asset side, where you actually have a native token traveling within these blockchains, that's still being built out. Obviously, Bitcoin is the most inherent one that everybody knows about, but I still think people are very, very excited about what this can do, right? Because the way I look at it is, you know, there's this public ledger that gets reconciled every 10 minutes, just talking about Bitcoin. I mean, just the sheer possible applications of that you're seeing play out in the market, where you have entrepreneurs trying to build, and you know, who knows if it's the right business model or not, but they're trying to build, you know, medical records on top of Bitcoin. They're trying to build, you know, real estate transactions on top of blockchain technologies. They're trying to figure out ways that they can leverage this technology. And again, it's still early days where people are kind of throwing things against the wall and trying to figure out what sticks, because I think they realize that if they're able to leverage a different market along with crypto, that could be kind of the killer use case that people see out there. But I actually don't see it as one killer use case to trump them all. I think there's going to be a number of different applications and ways that people interact with it. And maybe in the future, people aren't even going to know that they're interacting with it and they're just going to be using it.
Just to pick on one of the examples you gave there, I think it was health records being stored on a sort of a blockchain. I mean, what would be the benefits of that?
You know, I don't work directly in that field, but I would just say that, you know, I think it's this idea that you have a ledger that's timestamped, that's immutable, that is also global in distribution and then decentralized. So I think all of those attributes kind of help not just medical industry, but any industry that has differing sets of information at different times. And it kind of level sets all of that onto an even playing field for everybody involved.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about some of the trading opportunities. You know, last time I remember we spoke a bit about arbing the various price discrepancies between various exchanges. And you sort of spoke about how it's a bit more difficult than what most people think it is on the surface. Where do you see possible opportunity for your average kind of independent self-backed trader? You know, I'm talking about things which aren't necessarily worthwhile for a bigger player like Cumberland, but might be worthwhile for smaller participants to sort of look into. Like, is there anything which you think is interesting, worthwhile investigating?
I'd say definitely on kind of the major exchanges or major coins out there that the opportunity is not there. You've had a number of entrants into the market where spreads have come in and markets have tightened, and any opportunities that may have presented themselves years prior, they are kind of getting taken up, and the space is getting a little bit more crowded there. But in terms of, I guess, other opportunities that maybe, you know, other people can be looking at, you know, I think one of the interesting things and developments of this year is the idea of like decentralized exchanges. Although we don't participate on any of the decentralized exchanges, I can see that being an interesting arbitrage opportunity for different folks who can. Granted, those markets are mainly focused on retail size transactions, and they have their own nuances, but you know, that's definitely an interesting development as more and more of these decentralized exchanges kind of come about.
So what is a decentralized exchange?
A decentralized exchange is almost just like a peer-to-peer exchange where people are trading with one another on kind of a singular network that allows them to kind of transfer and trade different crypto assets for one another.
And are these decentralized exchanges, are these just a recent development?
I'd say so, probably in the last year or two, but more so today as more people started to figure out kind of the interestingness about it.
Okay. And do you think this is possibly a way that, these sorts of exchanges are going to overpower is probably not the right word. But do you think this is sort of something that might catch on and sort of be a serious competition for the other exchanges that are already sort of running the game?
You know, I think that the idea is very fascinating. But as we've seen it play out over the last few years in terms of, Bitcoin adoption or Ethereum adoption or things like that, it's always going to be slower than what you think is going to actually happen. And so I think it's probably too far to tell exactly how these are going to impact the way that traditional exchanges work. But I'll just say that the idea is out there now, that someone has built this thing or built multiple things. And this idea of decentralized clearing, decentralized trading is now an idea out there that's working in practice. But again, I still see it kind of more within the retail circles. I don't, at this point, I'm not sure if there's going to be any institutional involvement just yet.
So how come you mentioned this? Because it's a very new thing. You feel like there could be some inefficiencies which traders could take advantage of. Is that why you sort of thought to bring that up?
No, I just think that it's an interesting development that kind of happened over this year. And you know, when you had mentioned just, well, what are the opportunities for other traders that may be out there, you know, on the quote unquote, the traditional markets of the crypto exchanges. I mean, the arbitrage opportunities are few and far between, but decentralized exchanges may be something that's more interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, cool. Bobby, you know, obviously I'm not... I don't follow the crypto market too closely. I do follow it with a little bit of interest and a little bit of skin in the game, but I don't. I'm not as involved in it as you are, obviously. You know, are there things which you feel as I should be asking you about, which I haven't? Are there any topics which you think are worthwhile discussing?
Sure. I mean, there's like this. Yeah, and people brought this up a lot last year. They continue to bring it up this year. It's, you know, when's this institutionalization of crypto going to happen? And, you know, how's it going to play out? I think you're actually seeing it kind of play out in two ways this year. I think there's been like an infrastructure play that I mentioned before. You know, you have more custodians today than you had last year. You have more venues, traditional venues, that have announced that they're going to get involved in the crypto asset space. You have the existing crypto exchanges that are trying to bolster their businesses and make things better on their side. You have a number of aggregator platforms out there that have emerged. And so all of that, to me, shows that the framework is being built, whereas last year that framework didn't even exist. And so this framework is being built, which I think is helpful for institutions to get more comfortable with the space.
That's sort of something you hear a little bit, like obviously being spoken about is like you said, when are the institutions going to be getting involved and more heavily involved in the space. It seems as though people kind of like the idea that institutions are going to begin involved in cryptocurrency markets. Why do you think people like that idea?
You know, I think it provides some level of validation to the market that some of the most sophisticated investors or investment teams out there have now, you know, whether they want to look at it as like a stamp or a stamp on the industry or something like that, that provides them some level of comfort that, hey, even these folks are now involved in cryptocurrencies that means that it's now mainstream. But I'll just say that, you know, I think there has been a misconception over the past few years of what involvement looks like or adoption looks like. I think a lot of people had speculated, and me to a degree as well, that these institutions are going to come to the market and they're basically just going to buy coins and the price is going to kind of run up over time. I think you've seen it actually play out differently. And, you know, people say, well, the institutions aren't involved. And I'll say, you know, I just don't think they're involved in the way that you're looking at it. You know, and I think the Yale announcement was something very, very interesting, right? These investors and institutions are now participating in not just the coin aspect of it, but they're looking at it from a vehicle perspective of different, you know, whether it's a fund that's investing in things and they're investing in hybrid models as well. They're investing in funds that are also investing in coins, but also taking a more VC style approach towards protocols and things like that and other infrastructure plays.
Bobby, you were recently featured in a Financial Times article, and you said something to the extent of, you know, we're not in this just for a year or two. We see a bigger picture down the line in regard to cryptocurrency markets. You know, for you, what does that picture look like?
I think what I mentioned earlier just about whether it's, or I guess mainly, it's the idea that we're going into to new territory, new markets. And for me, that's obviously that's a bet that we're doing on the industry in terms of helping it grow, helping it adopt, and taking our best practices that we've done here in the US to Asia and then even broader to, you know, to Japan and Korea. And so I think for us it's bringing kind of a level of sophistication and standards that we've seen in other markets that are traded at DRW and trying to instill those practices into still this very growing asset class.
Very good, man. Very good. All right, we can probably leave it there, I think, unless there's anything else you wanted to bring up.
No, I think thought this was great, yeah.
Okay, cool. So you're on Twitter. What is your Twitter handle, Bobby?
It's Robert J. Cho. Robert, the letter Jersey Cho. Yep.
Okay, cool. And if someone's interested in learning a little bit more about Cumberland, where's the best place to go?
You know, our website is probably the best place, www.cumberland.io. And that's probably the best information they're going to be able to get.
Okay, very good. Cool, man. Well, I appreciate you coming on the podcast for the second time. It was really great to speak again. Obviously, there's been a bit happening since last time, so I'm glad we could do this.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And I'm going to have to check in with on the merch store that you have, see if you have any new stuff going on.
I'll send you a tea. You can wait around
good.
The office.
All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it.
You've reached the end of this episode of Chat with Traders. But rest assured, there are more episodes loaded with real market insight and zero hype on the way soon. So to stay updated with each great new release, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you'd leave a rating and review. We'll catch you next time on Chat with Traders.